So thanks for coming into the bank's offices today. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. This morning, I'm going to talk to you a bit about the review that we've published on the Term Funding Facility, or the TFF. This is the fourth installment of the series of reviews that we've undertaken on unconventional policies that the bank used during the COVID-19 pandemic. So cast your mind back to March 2020. The economic outlook was bleak. It was highly uncertain. Financial markets here and globally were in quite a bit of turmoil, and there was limited scope to lower the cash rate further. And so it was in that environment that the RBA pursued a package of policies to support the economy. The TFF review considers how that element of the package worked, whether it achieved its aims, and the lessons that we drew for the future. I'm going to cover some of the key points here, but there really is a lot of detail in the review itself, which has just been released. So let's start with what the TFF was intended to do. It really aimed to do two things. The first was to lower the cost of borrowing for businesses and households by lowering lenders' funding costs and to reinforce the benefits to the economy of the lower cash rate. The second thing was also to encourage banks to lend to businesses, particularly small and medium-sized enterprises, given that business credit tends to fall in downturns, and we had certainly expected a downturn. So how did it work? Well, the TFF provided low-cost three-year funding to banks, which also indirectly helped to lower the cost of borrowing from wholesale markets, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Under the TFF, banks had access to cheap funding up to an amount that was based on the initial size and then subsequent growth of their loan book. The interest paid was initially fixed at 0.25%, and this was then lowered to 0.1% in step with the reduction in the cash rate target in November 2020. A bank was able to secure additional TFF allowances if it increased its overall lending to businesses, particularly smaller businesses. So for every dollar of additional credit that a bank extended to large businesses, that bank was eligible for another dollar of TFF funding. But for each additional dollar that bank extended to an SME, then banks had five more dollars added to its TFF allowance. Banks could access their allowances up until the end of September 2020. But by the time of the September board meeting, so very early in that month, the economy was still quite far from the RBA's goals and considerable downside risks remained. The board decided at that time to extend the facility and increase banks' allowances, and the banks could then access these new allowances for a three-year fixed rate loans until mid-2021. Now, the TFF funding was much cheaper than other sources of term funding, and I'll show you that in a minute. And so, unsurprisingly, banks took up most of their TFF allowances as shown here. Ultimately, the TFF provided $188 billion worth of funding, and that was equivalent to about 6% of the stock of credit outstanding at the peak of the TFF's use. Banks repaid all of the TFF funds as scheduled at the end of June this year, and did so without incident. To summarise its effect on funding costs for banks and others with access to wholesale funding markets, the TFF lowered banks' funding costs directly. For the major banks, the TFF was around 60 basis points cheaper than issuing bonds during the TFF drawdown phase. It lowered their average cost of funds by around 5 basis points. But together with other parts of the policy package, the TFF also indirectly helped to lower the cost of wholesale funding. With the TFF in place, banks, they didn't really need to issue bonds, but investor demand for those and other similar securities still remained quite strong. And that strong demand, coupled with a sharp fall in the supply of bank bonds, contributed to a decline in yields on a range of existing and newly issued securities. And this included securities issued by non-major banks, and so those smaller banks continued to issue bonds. Non-bank lenders, they also benefited significantly. Their issuance of residential mortgage-backed securities, which is shown here in this chart, that's a key source of their funding. That issuance picked up significantly as the cost of issuing that those securities dropped very sharply, as shown here. So did the TFF achieve its aims? Well, the banks passed on lower funding costs through to retail lending rates for both households and businesses on both new and outstanding loans. So on average, outstanding lending rates fell by almost 100 basis points, and that's a little more than the 84 basis point estimate decline in banks' overall costs of funding. The fall in business rates, that was comparable when we look at variable and fixed rate loans, with a larger reduction actually for SMEs than was the case for larger banks. But the fall in mortgage rates was much more pronounced for fixed rate loans. The decline in fixed rates was also pretty large compared to the reduction in the cash rate when we go back and look at previous phases of easing. Banks' decisions to provide fixed rate mortgages at very attractive rates, that was consistent with the very low fixed rate TFF funds, as well as the fact that banks chose to focus their competitive efforts in the fixed rate sphere of the mortgage market. So households and businesses that took out those fixed rate loans, they benefited from particularly low fixed rates that were on offer at the time. And the share of new housing lending at fixed rates rose from around 15% at the start of the pandemic to a historic high of over 45% by mid-2021. So not only were existing borrowers switching from the variable to fixed rates, but new mortgage lending also picked up noticeably through 2020 and 2021, as you can see in this graph. In addition, lower rates contributed to a pickup in disposable income of debtors. And so in these various ways, the TFF, together with these other parts of the policy package, the TFF helped to support dwelling investment, the housing market more broadly, and other elements of aggregate demand. The TFF was also, as I said, was also intended to support the availability of credit, and we were particularly concerned that banks might have been reluctant to continue to extend credit to businesses during such difficult times. The TFF is likely to have played some role in underpinning business credit. It encouraged demand by contributing to lower rates for borrowers, but it also encouraged banks to expand lending to businesses to obtain those additional low-cost TFF loans. Indeed, business credit, as shown here, held up better during the pandemic than in comparison to the global financial crisis shown in blue here, where it fell quite noticeably. Such sort of declines that we saw during the GFC had also been evident in earlier economic downturns. So that didn't happen this time around. Despite the supporting role of the TFF, though, the total business credit may not have increased through 2020 and 2021, for a number of reasons, and that included a lack of business confidence at the time, and also the reduced need for business credit, given that there was sizable government support that was supporting businesses' cash flows. And despite the considerable incentives in the TFF to expand SME lending, staff estimates that we've done internally found no statistically significant effect on total SME lending compared with large businesses. So some banks did extend more credit to SMEs, but overall, the banking system as a whole didn't. While not an explicit goal, one other benefit of the TFF was the indirect support it provided to the public sector balance sheet. And by supporting stronger economic outcomes, the TFF, along with these other measures that the bank undertook, contributed to higher tax revenues and lower support payments to households and businesses than would otherwise have been the case. So let's turn to the question of how much the TFF cost. The TFF was part of the insurance that the RBA explicitly took out against a catastrophic economic outcome. While some of the TFF's design features underpinned its significant use by the banks and hence its economic benefits more broadly, these were also associated with financial costs for the RBA. The total cost to the RBA is estimated to have been $9 billion or thereabouts. And there are several reasons for this cost. First, the choice to supply funds at a fixed rate, that was intended to give banks and their borrowers certainty and therefore reinforce the other elements of the policy package, so most notably the bank's three-year yield target and its forward guidance. But the economic recovery and the increase in inflation turned out to be much stronger and started much earlier than the initial upside scenarios considered, not just by us, but also by other economists. And as a result, the board ended up raising the cash rate target, as you can see here in this chart, by much more and much sooner than had been expected. So while the TFF was profitable for the RBA up until May 2022, once the cash rate increased, the RBA was paying banks more interest for the balances that they kept at the Reserve Bank of Australia than the low fixed rate the banks had been paying on the banks had and were paying on the TFF funds. Because the banks passed these lower funding costs on in full, households and business borrowers who'd locked in low fixed rates were the ultimate beneficiaries as interest rates rose. Now, the second element of the cost, which accounts for around $4 billion of the cost, was the result of the board's decision to extend the TFF in early September 2020. At that time, the banks had taken up just under 60% of their initial TFF allowances, with almost half of that occurring as late as August. So this suggested that the banks did not need TFF funding to compete for or to satisfy the demand for borrowing that they were seeing from households and businesses. Rather, the banks waited until as late as practical to draw down the TFF funds because doing so extended the time the TFF would contribute to meeting regulatory liquidity requirements of the banks. I won't go into the mechanisms of that, but there's a lot of detail more in the review itself. And you can see here a similar pattern of late take-up was later observed with the second tranche of the TFF. So what about some of the lessons for the future? Well, the TFF did deliver on its goals. It lowered borrowing costs for a range of borrowers, it kept credit flowing to the economy, it supported aggregate demand. In addition, along with other measures, including the purchase of bonds in the early weeks of the pandemic, it helped to restore confidence in financial markets, which were significantly disrupted in the early days of the pandemic. Based on the findings of the review, the board judged that a term lending tool of this kind would be worth considering, again, if it was warranted by extreme circumstances. But there were some valuable lessons that we've learned along the way that could help to shape any future program of this type. So central banks can choose between fixed or variable rate facilities. The fixed rate option was chosen for the TFF in part to reinforce these other policies, the yield target, forward guidance. Such packages can be particularly valuable when the standard interest rate lever is already near zero and significant downside risks to the economy remain. But the flip side to a fixed rate facility is that it's lacking flexibility. And given the large take-up of the TFF at the very low fixed rate, it incurred a material financial cost to the RBA when economic recovery and the pickup in inflation turned out to be much stronger and start much earlier than had been expected. Many non-bank lenders, they were concerned at the time that the TFF would undermine their competitive position vis-a-vis the banks. We certainly received and heard their complaints loud and early. We had expected the TFF, however, to help lower rates in funding markets, which would have been to their benefit, at least to a degree. But what we learned is this effect was much stronger and much more pervasive than even we had anticipated. The TFF helped to lower funding costs significantly for a range of lenders and corporations that had no access to the TFF funds. It's hard to identify the specific contribution of the TFF to those lower funding costs separately from the effects of the other parts of the package, but staff estimates suggest that these indirect effects cause yields on RMBS, for example, to be around 50 basis points lower than they otherwise would have been. Another lesson is the importance of collaboration with other government agencies and regular contact with industry participants. Collectively, this helped financial stability risks associated with the TFF to be well managed. Amongst other things, this included monitoring and managing banks' refinancing tasks and liquidity needs well ahead of the repayment of their TFF loans, although that task could have been more challenging under less favourable market conditions. But as it was, it went smoothly. Similarly, for households and business borrowers, the RBA, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, and the banks themselves, close monitoring by all of us, and the bank's prudent lending standards, that all helped to reduce the risks associated with the rise in borrowers' mortgage payments when their very low fixed rates reset to something much higher. Only a very small share of borrowers struggle to meet the increase in their mortgage obligations when their low fixed rates expire. One of the important lessons is the value of planning ahead, being ready for a wide range of operational contingencies. Now, at the time, we got the TFF up and running quickly, in part by relying on existing, well-understood practices. But the speed with which the RBA designed and then implemented the TFF also limited our ability to fully consider and manage the associated risks. So forward planning can expand the options available, can help us to better weigh up the costs and benefits of each, and prioritise any preemptive operational work. On that latter point, for example, floating rate term lending, that would have been very challenging to put in place, both for the RBA but also for the commercial banks back in early 2020, because neither the RBA nor the banks at that time were readily able to undertake floating rate repos. And those are the things that the TFF, sort of underpin the TFF. The RBA and the banks, though, have since upgraded their systems and now have the capacity to easily undertake either floating or fixed rate repos. Clearly, design features, they can have competitive implications. And while the RBA staff liaise with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission during the TFF setup, it would be helpful to consider competitive implications ahead of time for any future facilities. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, the board has agreed to strengthen the way it considers risks, including by examining a wide range of economic scenarios when making policy decisions, involving unconventional tools and how to judge appropriate exit paths from such tools. In retrospect, and it's talked about in the review, a greater focus on potential upside economic outcomes could have led to different calibration of the TFF, including deciding potentially not to extend it in September 2020. So let me just sum up. The TFF met the objectives we set out for it at the start of the pandemic. It, along with other measures, helped to prevent dire economic outcomes at a time when the outlook was bleak and highly uncertain, and there was limited scope for further cuts to the cash rate. The TFF contributed materially to lower lending rates for households and businesses by reducing funding costs directly for the banks and indirectly for other institutions that borrow from wholesale funding markets. It kept credit flowing to households and businesses at a time when banks might otherwise have curtailed their lending. It helped to prevent a much more severe economic downturn, and the TFF therefore also contributed to stronger public sector balance sheets than otherwise. Would the RBA use a term lending tool again in the future? Well, the board would consider such a tool in extreme circumstances, again, when the cash rate target's been lowered to the full extent possible. But it would do so only after consideration of a wide range of scenarios and the associated risks, and would also do so with a broader range of operational options than were available at the time of the pandemic. Just in terms of what's next, in line with the recommendations from the external review of the RBA, we'll be publishing a framework for additional monetary policy tools next year. The broader set of lessons learned from the combination of the use of all these unconventional policies that will feed in and be considered as part of that framework. Thank you for coming, thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer a few questions. Now, I believe there's a mic, and if there's a question down here on the left, we might start here and then we'll go around the room.
Thanks, Chris, for taking the question. It's Lucas here from the Australian Financial Review. I was just wondering, given the TFF reduced mortgage rates quite materially, how much harder did it make it for households during the tightening cycle, do you think, when banks had to quickly reprice to respond to higher funding costs and shoot up in the cash rate?
Well, I would actually argue that it would have made it easier for households because the economy started in a much stronger position. Indeed, that's why rates were rising. The counterfactual, the alternative, would have been much worse. If we had to raise rates while unemployment rates were high because of inflation, that would have been quite problematic. The other thing I mentioned that particularly APRA and the banks were onto was this risk. And so what the banks were doing were contacting all of their borrowers that had these big resets coming well in advance, reminding them the sort of increase they were going to be facing, suggesting they start to get their things in order. And what we found for most of the borrowers that when they did switch from fixed rates to variable rates, they didn't really look any different from the variable rate borrowers who are already experiencing these sort of incremental steps as we were raising rates. So I think that's the answer.
The other thing I was wondering was, outside another pandemic, what sort of situation would you envisage require another TFF-like policy?
Well, again, I think it would have to be pretty extreme because our powerful tool is just to lower the cash rate. We considered at length how far we could lower the cash rate. We decided, because of the nature of our financial system, close to zero was about it. We wouldn't go below zero. But I think once we're at whatever the board judges is the effective lower bound, if downside risks still remain prominent, then that's when the board would consider such tools and perhaps not a term funding facility as in this form, but the potentially a facility of some sort.
And just last one, I was wondering, given how materially reduced mortgage repayments for households, I mean, how much consideration was there given into how it might have played into the inflation?
I think after the fact, very stimulatory monetary policy, and I think we've said this before, including from through 2022, very stimulatory monetary policy, significant savings in households and business, and the fiscal support that was still in place that was pretty significant did play a role in generating more demand than otherwise. But, you know, the inflation really started with a big supply shock as well that we have to recognise that nobody expected. We'll pass here and we'll get round.
Okay, Chris, hi, it's Ian Rogers from Banking Day. Look, you mentioned that you did consider scenarios that have been dealt with in crisis planning, but can you give us a bit more colour? To what extent was the TFF invented on the fly, and to what extent did it resemble what was already in the toolbox?
So we had done a bit of work because the cash rate was heading lower in 2019, and we had the benefit of looking at what other central banks had done, particularly in the GFC, where they had needed to lower rates to very low levels to their effective lower bounds. We also saw there were other central banks that had funding facilities of a similar, but not exactly the same nature as what we came up with. We were liaising closely with them. So we had given it some prior thought, but a lot of work was done right around the time that the pandemic was breaking out. But I think we did have quite a benefit of looking at what others had done, and we quite actively thought through these different options. But one of the points I made is operationally we weren't ready to do an easy floating rate TFF, nor did it appear appropriate to the board at the time, given that they were wanting to pursue a three-year yield target and forward guidance. So the fixed rate TFF married very much into those other tools as well.
Thanks, Chris. Martin Whitten, Westpac. On your last chart, the take-up towards the end accelerates quite quickly, as you pointed out. I think you said 60% from August onwards in the first iteration, similar for the second. Is it possible to decompose that to see how much of that takedown was actually lent out? Or do you think that's... nefarious is maybe too much of a strong word, but was that an opportunity for the banks to get fixed rate funding and put it at 10 over?
Well, my staff have heard me say this before. Money's fungible, so you can't really perform that exercise. I mean, the banks don't sit idly on funds that aren't earning them very much. And the funds in their accounts were earning them less than they were paying on the TFF. So they had every incentive to lend them out if they could. More broadly, that's what they do with all their funding, right? They get the balance between sort of their funding, their amount of capital they have to hold, the liquidity. So I don't think there's a sense in which they were sort of holding back, because holding back wouldn't have benefited them. The broader point I was trying to make was that there were many downside risks still facing the board at the time they decided to extend the TFF. But the other point was the banks were no longer relying on the TFF for their funding needs. At the time we put it into place, right, remember, and it's hard to remember back to then, but there was a global financial crisis in the making. US Treasury markets were shutting down. So forget about banks borrowing, the US Treasury market was grinding to a halt. Now, what we did, what other central banks did, what the Fed did, started to ease those constraints up, markets started to work again properly. But there was a real fear for a time, including when the TFF was put in place, that markets would remain dysfunctional for a long time. And if banks are wanting to pull back anyway, because of uncertainty of lending to businesses, particularly at such a time, if they don't have the funding, it's going to make that decision even easier. So we thought this was a really important backstop to give confidence to the banks and financial markets more broadly. And indeed, I think the announcement of the TFF did a lot of that, along with the other package, parts of the package.
Peter Hannon from Guardian. I guess generals are always accused of sort of fighting the last war. And I'm just wondering, I mean, you mentioned in the review that, you know, the RBA should strengthen the way it considers a full range of scenarios. I'm just wondering what kind of changes have kind of come around since 2020 that you would need to sort of factor in, for instance, greater growth of digital currencies or crypto and so on, that might make the next time you need a TFF different. And also, are there any lessons that are being learned from what happened in overseas markets, not just what happened in Australia?
I think partly informed by what we saw in overseas markets was that they had many similar parts of, many elements of our package, like the bond purchase program or QE, were being used by others. Many other central banks had term funding facilities of some sort. The fact that ours was a fixed rate one was part of the reason why it was so successful in encouraging banks to really lower mortgage and borrowing rates. You know, I showed that table earlier that showed how much rates had come down for fixed rate borrowers, but also variable rate borrowers, and for small and medium-sized enterprises. So that should not be denied. But other central banks had variable rate facilities. So that would be on the cards to consider next time. The other part, elements of the review of the yield target was quite critical of the first extension of that, where not enough attention was sort of paid at the time to those upside risks. So you could do things a bit differently, even going back in time. It's easy with hindsight, right? And once we're looking back knowing that vaccines worked, right, and gave a lot of confidence, and then economies were able to sort of break out of their lockdowns and bounce back very quickly. So it's easy to sort of criticise and look back and say they were unnecessary. But you could have followed different paths. You could have had variable rate TFF. You could have had a TFF that maybe wasn't rolled out for that second tranche. You could have relied on other sort of policies. and you know, a yield target, would we use that again? The board hasn't ruled that out, but the review that was conducted was quite critical of the extension of that the very first time. It pushed out another year. That's at around the same time as the TFF was rolled out.
Anything that keeps you awake about the next crisis that would looks like it would be different?
I think the only thing is it's going to be different. It's going to have many different elements to it. And we have to be careful to judge the past and, too harshly, because again, with the benefit of hindsight, that's always much easier. But the board, I mean, one of the reasons why the board's conducting these reviews is to learn some of these lessons, to think about different ways of doing things, different ways of marrying up packages if needed. And you have to be, I think you have to be flexible. You have to say, well, what are the circumstances we're facing? As I said, the cash rate is a very powerful tool in Australia. So the next sort of crisis that we might face that comes from whatever direction, the cash rate reduction, if it's needed, might be enough. But that'll be for the board on the day to decide. We'll just arm them with the lessons, different options, and perhaps a wider range of options and scenario analysis than we had at the time of the pandemic. Other questions? Swati? Well, we'll start here and then we'll go to Swati after this one. You've got the mic, so then we'll move over here later.
Yeah, Ken Compton from NAB. I noticed in the reviews of the TFF and the other components that have come out already, there's been a reasonable focus on the bottom line, you know, accounting mm-hmm. cost of the policies, the $9 billion that you've talked about mm-hmm. for today, and the losses on the QE bond portfolio, et cetera. Is the focus on that or the inclusion of that more of an auditing point for the RBA, or is it a significant a point that's going to be of significant importance in considering this alternative policy framework going forward? Will you look for the lowest cost alternative policy option to some extent?
I don't know that we'd look at the lowest cost. I think one of the reason it gets prominence is because these financial costs are easy to estimate directly for us. The harder things to estimate are the contribution of any one program, the TFF, for example, by itself, to the economic outcomes that we saw. And it may have been that the bank and the Australian public more generally were willing to pay those costs in order to avoid these really big, dire outcomes, which were quite possible, right? They didn't play out that way. But it's a bit like any insurance. If you've got fire insurance, you're really happy as the fire's passing around you. Once it's passed and your property's untouched, if you paid a lot for it, you always regret it after the fact. But you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you stop having any insurance. So I think it's partly gets attention because it's easy to measure compared to the benefits, which are really hard. What is the benefit of the unemployment we didn't have that you couldn't see, right? And it's very hard to also measure what's the benefit to, the public sector balance sheet. Swati, we pass the mic back to the corner.
Thanks. Swati from Bloomberg News. Chris, I was hoping somebody would ask this question here, but since nobody has asked, active quantitative tightening, mm-hmm. Is that dead given that we are in this elevated inflation environment and the bar to increase interest rates seem to be pretty high at this point? Is there any fresh view around active quantitative tightening? Was that something that was discussed as well?
The board has discussed it from time to time, and the latest thing we've said is that we like to review the case for active QT from time to time. So we'll let you know when we've done that. At this stage, I can't really add any more than, you know, it's under review from time to time.
And that would be considered in the next year's framework as well?
QE would be rolled into that consideration of the broader package, how they all work together, but also what we might use going forward, or at least lessons for the future if faced with dire circumstances that required something more than just a reduction in the cash rate. Just one qualification on the active QT. I think we've tried to make it very clear, and so that's why I'll emphasise it now. Any decision on that would have very little, if any, bearing on the stance of monetary policy and financial conditions. That's because, and I think that's what all central banks that are pursuing QT in whatever form have been saying, it's because when you're not restricted by the lower bound, you can really get much better control by moving your policy, your short-term interest rate, your policy tool, like the cash rate, around. And you don't need to be moving these other more cumbersome instruments around to get what the financial conditions that you want.
Hi, Richard from Westpac. I guess I just wanted to get an idea of when you were putting the policy in place, was there a view on what it would mean as it started rolling off, given the size that's gone into the pool of the bank's ES accounts, and then obviously the impact of that now coming off, moved to an ample reserves environment. Was that thought about when you were putting the policy in place, about what would be left in the pool?
Yeah, very much. And I talked a bit about the value that we recognised at the time, and then we've acknowledged in this review, of close liaison not just with the banks but also with the regulator, so in this case APRA. And we were definitely, we weren't meeting in person at that time, but talking to APRA with some frequency about exactly that issue. What would this mean and how would it be managed by the banks? And then APRA again were going to the banks and saying, if you're taking out large chunks, and particularly if, once they notice, well, they weren't taking them up till August and then September for the first tranche and then repeated, that means you're going to have lumpy needs in the future. So what they were asking the banks to do, and what the banks sensibly did, was start funding some of those repayments well in advance, because you don't want them all showing up to the wholesale markets on the very last moment to all look for funds at the same time. So that was definitely on people's minds, on our minds, on the regulators' minds, and on the banks' minds. All right, well, thank you. Thank you again for coming today.